Task 3.
You will listen to this task just once.
You will hear some extracts. Read through the headings before listening. For each extract, choose the heading that best matches the information you have heard. Then, write the letter in the corresponding white box. There are two headings you will not need, and an introductory extract as an example. Now, read the headings. Example.
The Falkland Islands, the British colony in the South Atlantic, has fallen. But that's what Argentina is saying. It claims its marines went ashore as a spearhead this morning to capture key targets, including the capital, Port Stanley.
Mr. Speaker, sir, the House meets this Saturday to respond to a situation of great gravity. We are here because for the first time for many years, British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign power. After several days of rising tension in our relations with Argentina, that country's armed forces attacked the Falkland Islands yesterday and established military control of the islands.
Extract number one.
What does it take for the political parties to agree on how they're funded? The Conservatives have been pretty embarrassed in recent days by the taped indiscretions of their former co-treasurer, who resigned in a hurry when his remarks became public. And in turn are using the threat of a tanker driver's strike, there are talks tomorrow, to point up the extent of Labour's financial dependence on the trade unions. Taking the figures for the last quarter of 2010, for example, 88% of Labour's income came from the unions. The parties resume discussions on reform to the system after Easter. They'll resist anything too radical, for example, more public funding. We've talked a good deal about Conservative fundraising in the past few days for obvious reasons. Let's turn to Labour. First to our chief political correspondent, Ben Wright. And just paint the canvas for us, Ben. There are talks going to take place.
Extract number two.
It's now 5 years since the so-called Saffron Revolution, when thousands of monks poured onto the streets here to protest against the then military government's policies. Thousands of people of all ages and backgrounds joined them, and the days of the military junta looked numbered. But that brief blaze of hope was snuffed out by a violent crackdown that left as many as 100 dead, according to some estimates. Many monasteries were closed and monks assaulted and imprisoned. Since then, little has been heard of those who led that uprising. I've come to the Huwabi Monastery, about 2 hours' drive north of Rangoon, to meet Upinya Tiha, a monk who was at the centre of it all.
Extract number three.
This is rather space-age looking radio.
Whistling into life, a 65-year-old design classic, part of a large collection of mostly valve radios from the 20s through to transistors of the 50s and 60s, owned by Nicholas Logsdale, founder of the Listen Gallery in London.
Sounds like the BBC Radiophonics Workshop. Some of them are dreams and fantasies.
Dejan Sudic, director of the Design Museum, might well exhibit this collection one day. So revealing is it about the history of the wireless.
How many radios have you ended up with?
300 and something. Firstly, they spanned a period, a really interesting period in terms of the development of design, modernism, thinking about how people lived between the wars. And this idea of the wireless, fantastic. Sound and voice and music can come through the air and be picked up by these instruments. And we sort of take it for granted.
Can you give me...
Extract number 4.
Hello, Mr. Moss. Set out your thesis, first of all.
Well, my thesis is very simple, that children need nature. They need to play outdoors in the same way that they need good food, good sleep and good education. And if we do not allow them to go outdoors, there are all sorts of consequences in the short term and long term for them, for their physical health, obesity is rising, their mental health, and also just the fact that they'd be missing out on this wonderful, wonderful world out there that is so precious and needs us, needs the children and needs adults as much as we need it.
And you have real firm evidence, do you, that they go out less now than they used to?
Oh, all the evidence suggests this. I mean, we know that, for example, when I was growing up in the 1960s, 90% of eight-year-olds walked to school. Now, I don't know a child who walks to school now, certainly not on their own.
Extract number 5.
A survey for BBC Newsround for its 40th anniversary, happy birthday, suggests that the number of children at school who know the Lord's Prayer by heart, or more or less by heart, has fallen. But it's still over 50%. In 1972, the figure was about 90. But another finding is that children today seem more likely to say that religion is important to them than was the case 40 years ago, an intriguing one that. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, told the programme that he believed the Lord's Prayer was part of a culture that stretched beyond the confines of the church itself.
Quite apart from the fact that I think the Lord's Prayer is a prayer we ought to pray because it's a good prayer taught to us by Jesus. Also, if you don't know the Lord's Prayer, you won't pick up all kinds of echoes that you hear of it in speech, in literature, in plays and so forth. It's all this language is there in our DNA. As a country.
Extract number 6.
Now, not plain sailing, because you got to Juilliard, which was a huge achievement.
Yes.
But then
after I graduated, I knew I was destined to debut at the Met at 21 years old. And I went, I had a couple auditions, and everyone said, I'm sorry, but you're not ready yet. You're still green. And at that time, I just given up another full scholarship to the Manhattan School of Music. And I didn't tell my mom that I was going to give up the scholarship because I really felt that I was ready for the stage. And I called her and I said, Mom, I'm not ready yet. And she says, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I don't know. I gave up my scholarship. And so I had to get a job. A normal job. I actually got about 4 jobs. I worked as a carpenter's assistant at Juilliard, making doors, hinges, cutting keys, fixing toilets. I worked at Carnegie Hall as a receptionist.
Extract number 7.
To celebrate her 70th birthday a couple of years ago, Lady Steele snuck off to a tattoo parlour in Selkirk to have a yellow-pink jaguar tattooed on her shoulder, without trying the idea out first on her husband, David, Lord Steele of Akewood, the former Liberal leader. The animal in question was taken from his coat of arms that accompanied his peerage. I do tend to flaunt it, she says. Unfortunately, well, she can't flaunt it on radio, but she is in our Selkirk studio, and we're joined also by Daryl Gates, who owns Diamond Jack's Tattoo Parlour in Soho. Lady Steele, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Now, why the sudden formality? You've never called me Lady Steele before.
Well, we won't go into that. Now, what does it look like?
Well, it's a jaguar, which was on his coat of arms. I should say, he's not the kind of person who goes for a coat of arms for the sake of having one.
No, no.
But when he became a Knight of the Thistle, it's compulsory to have one, and it's compulsory.
This is the end of task 3 and the end of the listening test.